The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2024 issue. We begin with our feature story, Sleep Spelunking. Embarking on a month-long experiment in Mammoth Cave, a pioneering physiologist pulled the science of sleep from obscurity. When University of Chicago physiologist Nathaniel Kleitman told fellow faculty members he was seeking a locale for a month-long sleep experiment, someplace as isolated from the rhythms of day and night as the Arctic in summer, a colleague in the geology department said he knew just the spot. Between 10 million and 15 million years ago, in what is now South Central Kentucky, trickles of groundwater began probing the cracks in a fossil seabed. Over the eons, the pockets grew and grew until they formed the most extensive cave system in North America, over 400 miles of underground chambers, canyons, tubes, shafts, and passageways, interwoven with Stygian rivers. Within a few months of the suggestion, on June 4, 1938, Kleitman and a companion, a graduate student named Bruce Richardson, made the short hike to their Mammoth Cave camp, 140 feet beneath Earth's surface. Unlike the era's other trailblazing voyages, Lindbergh leaping the Atlantic, Byrd bagging the North Pole, this one would go inward, not just below terra firma, but deep into the mysteries of the human brain and body. The pair would spend 32 days and nights keeping to a 28-hour sleep-wake schedule, with their results having profound implications for the nascent science of sleep. Before Kleitman's expedition, only a handful of scientists studied sleep, and not a single one did so full-time. Most saw slumber as a non-event, a nightly state of suspended animation. Many considered it a vestige of humanity's primitive past, which could be minimized or eliminated altogether. Today, the quest to understand sleep and to apply that understanding to our daily lives has become a global obsession. Sleep researchers can be found in every major university. Over 2,500 sleep clinics operate across America, and 4,000 more in other countries. The World Sleep Society, which represents scientists and healthcare professionals on every continent but Antarctica, boasts 14,000 members. Over the past 90-odd years, sleep has gone from an afterthought to a central element in our notions of well-being. How sleep science evolved to its current state of sophistication is thanks to the efforts of early sleep explorers like Kleitman, who spent decades working to solve puzzles whose importance few others could grasp. When they hit dead ends, they analyzed their errors and set off in new directions. They risked futility and failure to advance a field that was widely regarded as scientifically irrelevant. In the process, they changed our nights and days forever. In the years before entering Mammoth Cave, Kleitman had set himself one central task: to transform sleep science from an obscure backwater into a thriving discipline. In the early 1930s, he had launched a series of studies aimed at scrutinizing sleep with a granularity no one had yet attempted. He had intertwined goals to analyze the rhythms of sleep and test how different variables in waking behavior affected sleep rhythms. By charting factors such as body temperature, body movement, and mental acuity at different times of day and night, and under varying conditions and routines, he hoped to map not only the contours of normal sleep, but also to learn what distinguished it from abnormal varieties. Of all the variables Kleitman aimed to examine, only body temperature had been studied extensively. It had long been known that temperatures in humans fluctuated by a degree or two each day, reaching a minimum sometime after midnight and a maximum in the afternoon. Kleitman hypothesized that the daily cycles of both temperature and sleep were dictated by patterns of habit and behavior, such as food intake, muscular exertion, and brain activity, rather than rhythms intrinsic to the brain or body. He also posited that both cycles could be changed without harm, although a person might need some time to adjust. For a month, Kleitman tried to shift his own sleep-wake rhythm to follow a 48-hour schedule rather than the traditional 24-hour one. His temperature rhythm stayed stubbornly in place. When he placed a student on a 12-hour cycle, the subject's temperature curve again refused to follow. Kleitman even tried less radical alterations, placing himself and several students on cycles lasting 21 or 28 hours. Some students were able to acclimatize, but Kleitman's temperature stuck to the 24-hour cycle, and he felt more irritable and exhausted with each altered day. Why couldn't he adjust? Were his cortical circuits less adaptable than those of other subjects, or were they more sensitive to external stimuli? It was impossible to tell without controlling for such stimuli, including the cues of sunset and sunrise. Hoping to eliminate those variables, Kleitman headed to Kentucky. At their camp, a vast chamber about a quarter mile from the cave entrance, 2,500 feet long by 150 feet wide, it was imperative the researchers receive no sensory cues to the cycles of the 24-hour world. Richardson had also found it impossible to adjust to a 28-hour schedule in previous experiments. The question was whether the pair would do better underground. Kleitman and Richardson kept to a strict regimen, attempting to sleep from 12 a.m. to 9 a.m. Sunday, 4 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday, and so on, 9 hours in bed and 19 hours out for each cycle. Cave workers brought meals, mail, newspaper, and smoking supplies twice a day and spirited away the contents of the chamber pots. Portable generators powered the scientific instruments, and gasoline lamps supplied the light, casting shadows on their specially built beds and bedside tables stacked with equipment. To pass the time, they organized data, wrote letters, read periodicals and books, brushed up on bridge rules, and took brief walks around the cavern. With the air a constant 54 degrees Fahrenheit, they wore overcoats, hooded sweaters, galoshes, and two layers of woolen pants to ward off hypothermia. Every 2 hours, they measured their temperatures, relying on alarm clocks to rouse them during sleep periods. As they lay dreaming, the motion detectors kept vigil, disgorging ticker tape into a box beside each bunk. For 5 28-hour cycles, events in the cave went precisely as planned. But despite their desire for secrecy, Kleitman had requested that the project be carried out discreetly. The newspapers got wind of the expedition, and a swarm of reporters descended. On June 10th, Mammoth Cave manager W.W. Thompson sent a note with the food delivery begging Kleitman to allow a visit from a representative of the press. Kleitman consented to an interview, and a correspondent of the Associated Press arrived the next day. The 700-word dispatch turned out to be a humdinger, full of fascinating science and colorful details. "Neither man has shaved in a week," the correspondent reported. "There's no sunrise or sunset to disturb them, yet they find themselves still unconsciously guided by the 24-hour cycle that has ruled all their lives." He explained the project's rationale with admirable clarity and described the explorers' living conditions down to the cigarette packs scattered across the breakfast table. The men assured him that their spouses had no reason to worry. The only discomfort was a slight dampness to the sheets. "When wives have crazy husbands, they get used to their doing things like this," Kleitman said with a laugh. "And we feel that we may contribute something to the knowledge of men's reactions." The story was picked up across the country, and more reporters came calling. When Kleitman received a request to shoot a newsreel on the last day of the expedition, the scientist again said yes. The clip, which was shown in thousands of movie theaters, opens with the title frame, "Studying Mystery of Sleep, Scientists Live Month in Cave." "An alarm clock calls time on a unique experiment," an announcer states as Richardson awakens and Kleitman extracts a length of tape from the bedside box. "Two Chicago University experts, who, in the service of science, have been living in the depths of Mother Earth for more than a month, end their test." Then comes a close-up of Kleitman. "We were entirely successful in our undertaking," he says, but want it known that it is in no way a stunt or an act of endurance or perseverance, but a bona fide scientific experiment. The newsreel is in some ways misleading. Contrary to the scientist's declaration, the experiment was not entirely successful. Once again, Kleitman had been unable to acclimatize to a 28-hour schedule, while his student had done so within 2 weeks. Kleitman's body temperature continued on its 24-hour curve, and he always began feeling sleepy around 10 p.m., even when that time fell during the morning or afternoon of the artificial day. He later suggested that age or other variations among individuals accounted for the difference between his and Richardson's adaptability. The sample size, he admitted, was too small to draw conclusions. Yet such details did nothing to diminish the story's appeal. On July 7th, when the men climbed the 71 steps from the cave entrance to the surface, dozens of journalists, park officials, townspeople, and tourists thronged to greet them. What struck Kleitman most sharply, he told the newspapers, was the fragrance of the forest. A pleasant shock after more than a month with little to smell but dank stone, tobacco smoke, and bodily secretions. The clamor of the crowd must have been startling too, as well as the commotion of bats among the oaks and hickories and the brilliance of the sky. The headlines were gleeful. Scientific cavemen emerge. Scientists quit playing moles in sleep study. Old world looks strange after a month in cavern. To many Americans, the cave experiment was little more than a novelty. Its repercussions, however, can be felt to this day. Kleitman's eccentric expedition would inspire a spate of experiments that revolutionized our understanding of how sleep-wake rhythms function. More fundamentally, his emergence from Mammoth Cave marked a new era. The science of sleep had come out from underground. With one stroke, Kleitman convinced millions of people that sleep was of major interest and that it was a legitimate scientific field. While newspapers described how his 10,000 nights of scientific experiment had upset many popular ideas about the technique of sleeping, Kleitman cemented his preeminence in 1939 with the publication of the first true textbook on sleep science, a 638-page opus that would serve as the field's Bible for decades. Kleitman spent 6 years writing the tome, which covered virtually every study since the 1910s, including his own. Building on this foundation, Kleitman attributed nearly every aspect of the sleep-wake cycle to choices, behaviors, and sensory inputs, rather than some general properties of protoplasm, that is, biological rhythms. What makes people feel the need to sleep after an extended period of wakefulness? Fatigue of the cerebral cortex and of the muscles of the eyes, face, and neck, Kleitman said. What drives diurnal temperature rhythms? Different levels of mental and muscular activity during sleep and waking, though the temperature curve may persist through force of habit even when the sleeping patterns change. Kleitman's texts decisively established him as his field's foremost authority. In its pages, researchers could find a set of facts, concepts, problems, and techniques to serve as points of departure for new explorations. The discipline was developing a sense of intellectual coherence, as well as a modicum of influence. Yet its grasp of sleep's underlying mechanisms and its ability to actually improve people's lives remained limited. Not until years later were Kleitman's theories proven wrong, in part due to discoveries concerning the general properties of protoplasm, as well as new findings in neuroautonomy and electrophysiology. Today, scientists see sleep as part of a circadian cycle, a built-in biological clock tied to the 24-hour day. But without Kleitman's work, blazing a trail for the thousands of sleep scientists who followed in his footsteps, his knowledge might have remained in the shadows, trapped in a world as deep and dark as the caves of Kentucky. Is Earth the only Goldilocks planet? Some scientists believe the universe is teeming with life. Others aren't so sure. Humans have wondered about life in the universe since antiquity. Early Greek philosophers argued that the cosmos contained a plurality of worlds. Today we know that exoplanetary systems are indeed ubiquitous. But the question now is, how common are planets that can support life? In 2000, paleontologist Peter Ward and astronomer Donald Brownlee of the University of Washington in Seattle penned a controversial book, Rare Earth: Why Complex Life is Uncommon in the Universe. In it, they propose that Earth is an unusual world where complex life forms developed over an extended period. They further assert that though simple unicellular life may be abundant in the universe, complex life must be exceedingly rare. In sharp contrast, noted Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics astrophysicist Avi Loeb passionately argues in his book Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth, given the ubiquity of habitable planets, it is the height of arrogance to conclude that we are unique. The debate about habitability and life in the universe remains wide open. In the past, astronomers spoke of finding Goldilocks worlds, planets in the habitable zone, or HZ, of the stars, where the temperature was just right for liquid water on the surface. But the past two decades of research have shown that just because a planet lies in the HZ doesn't mean it's necessarily habitable. In Rare Earth, Ward and Brownlee suggest that for complex life to evolve, several requirements seem essential: a terrestrial-type planet of appropriate size with a stable orbit inside the habitable zone of a stable star. In addition, the planet needs the right atmosphere, plate tectonics, and a large moon, and must reside within the right type of system. If most of these attributes, they argue, are not met or in place for several billion years, complex life is unlikely to appear. Scientists recognize two types of habitable zones, stellar and galactic. The first is the orbital region around a star, where a planet can support liquid water on its surface. The second type is the galactic habitable zone, or GHC, encompassing a region in the Milky Way in which a star meets other criteria for supporting complex life. This region is far from the galactic center, where star density is much higher than in the sun's location. Hence, Earth is not exposed to potentially deadly supernovae and gamma-ray bursts detrimental to complex life. The concept of the stellar habitable zone has changed since its introduction by astrophysicist Su Shu Huang in 1959. He argued that the best candidates for hosting planets within habitable zones are probably F, G, and K stars, which range from about 0.6 to 1.6 times the mass of the Sun. While this assertion has pretty much stood the test of time, our Earth-centric perspective of habitability has since broadened significantly. As radio astronomer Alan Bridle of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Charlottesville, Virginia, succinctly puts it, "Habitable by what?" he asks. Supposing sentient creatures had happily evolved in an ocean under the ice of Enceladus or Europa, would they be mystified by arguments that the HZ for water-dependent life does not extend as far as Mars? So, are Goldilocks worlds like Earth capable of fostering technologically advanced life forms rare in our galaxy? When Rare Earth was published, only about 100 exoplanets had been found, most of which were easy to detect gas giants. What is the state of affairs 2 decades and some 5,000 planets later? Ward and Brownlee argue that the right type of star system for hosting complex life is one like ours, with a single main sequence star, rocky planets in its HZ, and an outlying gas giant like Jupiter. The Sun is G spectral class, which comprises about 9% of hydrogen-burning stars in the Milky Way. M-class dwarf stars are the most common and longest-lived stars. However, they seem less suitable because they bombard their planets with radiation from stellar flares. Also, because the HZs around M dwarfs are relatively close in, planets that are subjected to tidal forces that lock their rotation, leaving one side hot and one side cold. Solar-type stars appear most suitable because their luminosity doesn't vary as much, and they still have relatively long lives, 4 billion to 10 billion years. Higher-mass stars are hotter and shorter-lived. Other key components in the supposition that Earths are rare are the presence of Jupiter, our relatively large moon, and plate tectonics. Because Jupiter's gravitational influence deflected asteroids and comets away from the early inner solar system, it lowered the frequency of Earth impacts and allowed life to thrive and evolve. And the moon plays a crucial role by keeping our planet's tilt around 23 degrees, which ensures seasonal cycles and ocean tides are not too extreme. Our large satellite also generated tidal forces that induced plate tectonics in Earth's crust. Those processes are thought to allow steady evolutionary change, allowing life to diversify and grow more complex. Also deemed crucial are liquid water and our planet's magnetic field. Water, as we know, is vital for life on Earth, and our planet's strong magnetic field shields its surface from harmful solar radiation and cosmic rays, so it likely facilitated the genesis of complex life. Collectively, these considerations lead some to view our situation as so unlikely that other planets with beings as intelligent as us are improbable. We may be alone in the galaxy. Despite the arguments outlined above, most researchers today either withhold judgment or disagree with notions that Earth is anomalous. The consensus is that we simply do not have enough data to understand how Earth-like planets form and evolve over time. Although astronomers have detected more than 5,000 exoplanets so far, the bulk of them come from NASA's Kepler mission. There are limitations to this sample. Kepler preferentially detected relatively large planets close to their stars, while rocky planets were less likely to be spotted. That skews the exoplanet statistics and likely undercounts the number of rocky worlds. Researchers have also questioned some of the major tenets of the rare Earth hypothesis, like the scarcity of moons like Earths. As University of Arizona astronomer Chris Impey points out in The Living Cosmos, even if the moon is pivotal for life on Earth, there is no a priori reason that such moons can't form around other Earth-like planets. Opponents of the rare Earth hypothesis have also suggested that the influence of a Jovian planet in the solar system is far more uncertain than rare Earth asserts. In a 2008 series of papers titled Jupiter, Friend or Foe, Jonty Horner of the University of Southern Queensland and the late Barry Jones argue that rather than shielding Earth against external impactors, Jupiter had the opposite effect. Likewise, in a 2016 paper, planetary physicist Kevin Grazier reported computer simulations that found that Jupiter tended to keep comets' orbits from migrating outward, increasing the odds that they would collide with Earth. However, Grazier argues, this benefited life's development in a different way, by delivering life-enabling volatiles, including carbon, to the terrestrial planets. Should we learn that planets like ours are indeed infrequent or unusual as rare Earth proponents maintain, where would that leave us? It has taken more than 4 billion years for Homo sapiens to appear. If such timelines are universal, then perhaps we are the first in the galaxy to reach that status. This would explain the paradox posed by physicist Enrico Fermi in 1950. If intelligent life is common in the universe, then where is everybody? It's possible that intelligent civilizations are either rare or just emerging in the Milky Way, and our searches should adjust for that possibility. The rare Earth hypothesis leaves much room for speculation. We may have to rethink key factors. The first is the standard notion of habitability that centers around liquid water and a solid planetary surface. We must expand this to include the prospect that life may thrive underground, or in oceans under ice, as well as on moons orbiting planets. Second, our concept of life is by necessity Earth-centered, but that is clearly too narrow. Humans thrive in an aerobic environment, but several species of roundworms and crustaceans thrive in anoxic marine sediments, showing that aerobic respiration is not indispensable for animals, even on Earth. This is likely true on other worlds and raises the question of alternative life forms. Third, we still need stronger data on how common Earth-like planets are in our galaxy. Presently, only a handful of exoplanets fit the known criteria to be able to hold an Earth-like atmosphere. In a 2021 study, Giovanni Cavone and colleagues at the University of Naples analyzed the efficiency of photosynthesis on potential Earth-like planets in the HZ. This study puts strong constraints on the parameter space for complex life, Cavone said in a statement. Unfortunately, it appears that the sweet spot for hosting a rich Earth-like biosphere is not so wide. However, a 2020 NASA study suggested that about half of Sun-like stars could host potentially habitable rocky planets. Obviously, our picture is far from complete. Two additional factors regarding intelligence and survival of advanced civilizations are the Anthropic Principle and the Great Filter. First outlined in 1970, the Anthropic Principle attempts to define the credibility of our observations of the universe, given that we can only exist in this particular universe. Our existence would not be possible if the laws of physics were incompatible with the development of sentient life. This reasoning has been used to advance the notion that the universe is somehow fine-tuned for life. The Great Filter, in a nutshell, posits that we might be alone because there are so many improbable steps in the evolution of higher intelligence that it is unlikely to occur multiple times. Coupled with our potential to self-destruct, perhaps that's why technologically advanced civilizations are rare or don't last long, thereby explaining the Fermi paradox. In their soon-to-be-published new book, The Rare Earth Hypothesis, Ward and Brownlee double down on their thesis with what they consider even stronger supporting evidence. They posit that, from what we now know, rare might not be a restrictive enough term for describing the frequency of complex life in the cosmos. Their conclusion is based on comparisons of most of the exoplanetary systems so far characterized, and that no potentially habitable planet will remain so for long in almost every case without several crucial aspects. Foremost is an ability to maintain a temperature allowing the existence of liquid water for almost unimaginable periods of time, which they maintain is perhaps the most important aspect of life-supporting planetary systems. The authors also state that had a body the size of Comet Hale-Bopp struck us, there would probably not be a single microbe alive on Earth right now, let alone animals. In a paper titled The Astrobiological Weak and Strong Limits for Intelligent Life, astronomers Tom Wesby and Christopher Consalis of the University of Nottingham attempt to estimate how many communicating civilizations might exist in our galaxy at any given time, deriving models that assume an average lifetime of such civilizations as 100 to 200 years, based on our own ascent to radio communications capability. They conclude that, optimistically, there might be as many as 928 such civilizations within some 3,300 light years. More pessimistically, there might be only 36 within 17,000 light years. Clearly, in our efforts to assess whether Earth, and by extension humanity, is exceptional in the cosmos, no firm conclusions are possible. Only time will tell, although current evidence strongly implies that a Star Trek depiction of abundant civilizations in the galaxy must remain in the realm of science fiction. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.